Hey, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host today is Dave Allen, as we're going to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. And today is, yes, ladies and gentlemen, December 2nd, 2019. It's Monday. Good afternoon, Dave.
Happy Monday, Melody.
Oh, yes, what a day. I hope you had a great turkey day, and hopefully that you've got the tryptophan out of the systems, and it was a nice and a wonderful Thanksgiving being up there in Pennsylvania. Great weather, great traveling days, and it was also good to be with family. So I hope you had a good one too, Dave.
Had a great one, thanks.
Oh, wonderful. Let's go ahead and take a peek at the gold prices here. Today's just moving right along. Let's see, gold prices today, it struggled most of the day, but we're looking at gold down $1.90 at $14.63. Silver today is down 13 pennies at $16.98. Platinum was up $2 at $9.01, with palladium up 13 at $18.60. That number just keeps on rising. That is the what rhodium do today? Let's see. Well, for some reason, I guess the computers still have a little bit of tryptophan in them. They're not working as they should. Let's go ahead and go to the Dow, the paper markets today. Yeah, the Dow down 264 points at 27,786. Yeah, the NASDAQ down 97, 8,567. The S&P was down 27, 3,113. And we have, I don't know why my computer is acting bizarre, but we'll hit the other numbers here in just a little bit. And Dave, you just, for some reason, I just can't seem to open anything in a weird way, but I think I have it here. First, we're going to talk about manufacturing, and there was a report out today, manufacturing activity. It does continue to lag. It did in November, and it lagged in inventories and new orders. Now, this is all according to the latest ISM manufacturer reading that was released this morning. The reading came in at 48 and versus an expectation of 49. And I believe the previous month's reading was 48.3. So it was a little bit lower. And yeah, my computer is just all frozen up, Dave. So if you would like to continue through on the manufacturing and see if I can't get this logged back in, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Well, though the ISM reading that Melody just mentioned is usually reported as a simple number, it actually denotes the percentage of manufacturers planning to expand their operations. So, as you know, a reading below 50 represents contraction. November was the fourth straight month below the expansion level. As Melody mentioned, stocks fell on the report. The Dow Jones off more than 150 points at 10:30 a.m. after the release of that reading. Now, new orders slumped to 47.2. That's down 1.9 percentage points from October's 49.1. Inventories, which are a key input for GDP, came in at 45.5, down 3.4. The numbers come amid speculation about the pace of U.S. growth, which is slowing. Recession worries have ebbed somewhat from earlier in the year, at least in the eyes of some market analysts. We kind of beg to differ. You know, earlier in the year, the Treasury yield curve was inverted and flashing what has been a reliable recession indicator for the past 50 years. Now, GDP growth has averaged about 2.4% this year, with the third quarter coming in at 2.1%, according to the government. However, most forecasters expect the fourth quarter to come in under 2%. The report shows that manufacturing is stuck in a mild recession, with little prospect of a real near-term revival.
Keep going, Dave. My computer's still not working.
Well,
keep going.
This is going to weigh on job growth and capital expenditures over at least the next few months, to the point where, you know, we're not ready to roll out further Fed easing in January. By we're, I mean Pantheon Macroeconomics, their chief economist, Ian Shepherdson. Manufacturing is considered a reliable bellwether for how the rest of the economy is doing, though it comprises only about 20% of GDP. Nearly all of the key ISM indicators were at contraction levels in November. Now, in a related release, which just gives further rise to the thought of the economy as in schizophrenic mode, the market manufacturing reading, known as the PMI, the Purchasing Managers Index, indicated slight expansion, figure that, coming in at 52.6, just above expectations and a tad better than the 51.3 October reading. The market PMI growth reflected, according to its authors, an uptick in production and new orders, as well as strength in some employment indicators. It was the strongest reading, in fact, in 7 months. Oh boy, it certainly is dizzying when you consider essentially the same economic indicators being read differently by different indexes. Now, investors will get a closer look on Friday at the impact the manufacturing slowdown and trade war have been having on the broader economy. Of course, that's when the Labor Department's non-farm payrolls report comes out, with economists expecting a rebound in growth to 187,000 from the last one of 128,000. Of course, it is the holiday season, after all. Now, moving on, Cyber Monday. It is today. Now, holiday shoppers aren't headed to the store today necessarily, but they sure are still spending. As of 9 a.m. today, Cyber Monday shoppers had already spent close to $500 million in online sales, that according to Adobe Analytics. Cyber Monday online sales are on track to hit $9.4 billion today, about a 19% year-over-year growth. Between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. Eastern Time tonight, Adobe is expecting shoppers to spend almost $3 billion. That's 30% of the day's revenues. Shoppers are expected to spend $11 million per minute during the peak hour of 11 p.m. to midnight, as they jump on holiday deals just before they end. Now, as extreme weather hits a good chunk of the U.S. today, shoppers may be even more motivated to do their shopping from home. States that saw more than 2 inches of snow also saw a 7% boom in online sales. Now, last year's Cyber Monday sales were not $7.9 billion. But this year, shoppers didn't wait until Cyber Monday to start their online shopping. Retailers began these sales in early November, and lines were thin at stores on Black Friday as deals began on Thanksgiving Day. Black Friday was predicted to be the busiest shopping day of the year in the U.S. for shoppers to head out to stores. But even on that day, people were loading up, their online shopping carts. Online spending hit a record of $5.5 billion, up over 22% from last year. You know, stores like Best Buy, Target, Walmart, Dick's, and other big box retailers were the big winners thus far in the holiday season. And the department stores are still a tad slower. Those big box stores have proven themselves, though, in online sales. Walmart and Target both saw bigger jumps than Amazon, in fact, in online customer spending during the first 2 weeks of November. So, Melody?
I am back.
Hey!
I am back. My computer's back. I didn't go anywhere. I was here. but just had some issues. But it'll be interesting to see what these stores do and what the information that came out from, you know, if, how Black Friday did. You know, I've heard different stories. People saw a lot of people out. Then again, others thought that the stores were not so busy and so forth. I guess it's another, it just depends on where you were at, the time that you were there. But Nordstrom saw the biggest increase online sales during Black Friday compared with last year at 60%, followed by Walmart at 53% and Amazon at 49%. Target saw its online sales fall around 12% on Black Friday. JCPenney's didn't have a whole lot of room to fell around 14%. Smartphones. It's been the prime shopping tool this season, accounting for 36% of online sales so far, and that's about 24% higher than last year. I mean, that really is amazing. How I think it is anyway. But shoppers so far, they've spent a record $72 billion online between November 1st and December 1st. This past weekend alone brought in $7.4 billion in online sales alone. This is amazing. It's amazing numbers. But you got to remember, Dave, that's all debt. It's all debt.
Yep, we'll talk about that later on in the program, talking about business and household debt and how different aspects of each are just continuing to go up, up and away, to the point where, you know, more and more analysts are concerned about these explosive growth in debt over the last 10 years. Anyway, moving on to another subject and abroad, President Trump said today he was going to impose tariffs on steel and aluminum from Brazil and Argentina, thus widening a global trade war and hitting an ally, Brazil's conservative president. Trump, in a message on Twitter, said what he called currency manipulation by Brazil and Argentina was hurting American farmers. Quote, therefore, effective immediately, he tweeted, I will restore the tariffs on all steel and aluminum that is shipped into the U.S. from those countries. Now, the Trump administration never imposed tariffs on Brazilian and Argentine metals, though it did force them to limit shipments to the U.S. under a quota system last year. The U.S. initially exempted Brazil and Argentina from the president's sweeping steel and aluminum tariffs in 2018, with the White House saying it would continue negotiations with those countries on a trade deal.
Well, you know, last week, the Brazilian currency, the real, fell to a record low against the dollar. So maybe that was the what prompted the message today from President Trump. And, of course, that came after the country's economic minister signaled that he wasn't concerned about the exchange rate fluctuations. And, of course, we've seen the peso there. Their Argentina's peso has weakened with the country in the midst of an economic crisis. So it was a surprise announcement, I guess, Dave. And, you know, there's also been threats of new tariffs on products from China, Mexico, the European Union, Vietnam, and elsewhere. So the tariffs on Brazil and the Argentina suggest that Trump has not abandoned his approach to making America great again.
Well, you know, this thought of threatening American national security has been disputed by some, several countries bringing cases against the U.S. at the World Trade Organization. Many American steel producers supported the tariffs and say they've provided some protection against cheaper metals imported from abroad. But other economic factors, it seems, have proved more influential, including China's large-scale production and a weakening manufacturing sector in the U.S. and abroad. Tariffs have also angered American manufacturers of automobiles, machinery, food packaging, and other products who must pay more for the metal that they purchase. Both Argentina and Brazil benefited from the president's trade war with China, which has hurt American exports like soybeans and other products. Brazil and Argentina have picked up much of that slack, replacing the U.S. as a primary purveyor of farm goods to China.
So is that the relationship where earlier it had said that because of the currency manipulation it affected our farmers? It was because giant China was picking up the difference from them?
I think to a large extent that's the case. I'm not so sure that the currency manipulation was meant or intended to be tied to that aspect of trade.
Okay. Well, I don't. Some people are calling December Bob Lighthizer month.
Go Bob.
In the coming weeks, no single economic policymaker is going to have a bigger hand in shaping the future than, of course, the Bob Lighthizer. Four things are unfolding to make that so, even if all of them could still end up going in very different directions. First, there are effectively 13 days left for Lighthizer and his Chinese counterpart to nail down the details of a partial deal to avoid another escalation in trade war. If they don't do so by the 15th of December, there's possible another wave of tariffs from President Trump that would hit the supply chains of consumer, of course, like the smartphones, and we've seen the numbers on those, to the degree of people are purchasing them, laptops, and yes, even toys.
Well, a deal in itself may be more temporary anyway than, say, a transformative treaty, but the lack of an agreement would undoubtedly upset markets and intensify and extend the growth-sapping uncertainty that's plagued the U.S. and global economies this year. Now, the next factor that Lighthizer has as trade czar is one legislative win Trump is hoping for before the end of the year, and that's the passage of his renegotiated NAFTA by Congress. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, known as UMSCA, borrows heavily from the old NAFTA, and as well as the Trans-Pacific Partnership that had been negotiated by the Obama administration. UMSCA does have some important tweaks, including new auto content rules designed to encourage more production in the U.S. Those are Lighthizer's changes, and together with his careful cultivation of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other senior Democrats, they're also the only reason the UMSCA has a chance of passing the House sometime this month.
Well, our first segment of the program today has passed, and we're heading into a break, and we'll be returning in just a few short minutes. Please stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk Radio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Well, you know, it used to be that, you know, the economy was, you know, GM dictated what the economy was. And now, Dave, I see that you have some German car makers that are announcing some massive job cuts.
Well, it's true. We're reading that in the last few days. Volkswagen's Audi division, their management said it will cut as many as 9,500 people. BMW's management has stated it will cut several thousand people as well. Then on Friday, Mercedes parent Daimler said it will let thousands go. Some analysts believe the global car business is at the start of a recession. And if so, GM and Ford will face similar needs to chop costs very, very soon to stay competitive. The U.S. is the only large car market that's had relatively even sales in the last year. The annual rate of light truck and car sales is stated about $17 million for each of the last 4 years, which is an unprecedented run. Europe's car sales and those in the U.K., on the other hand, have dropped. Sales in the world's largest car market, China, have taken a dive this year, a reversal of years of growth there. GM and Ford both suffered double-digit sales fall-offs in 2019 so far. Without China's success, both have faced and continue to face extreme challenges.
You know, the Ford management, they said that it will have a multi-billion dollar restructuring with its pivot to electric and autonomous cars, which will cause job cuts. Some of them have already begun. GM, they started to cut staff, but at a little more modest rate. Ford and GM are far from the only companies which want their fleet sales to be mostly made up of electric and self-driving cars in the next couple of years. I think California passed a law where supposedly all government vehicles is going to be electric and so forth. However, there is no evidence that car buying public is prepared to move quickly away from gas-driven cars and hybrids. So they've been working on this for how long? I'm not sure why people are reluctant to move into those types of vehicles.
Well, one thing's for sure. I mean, if the big car makers are headed in that direction toward hybrids and all electric, at some point, you know, if you want a new car anyway, you're going to have little choice. But what it tells me that in the near term, the used car dealers are going to be bigger business than normal. The car senses, the car.coms, the car maxes, and so forth. So it'll be an interesting next year to see what unfolds further.
But, you know, but people, the buying of vehicles is what's going to dictate what they make. But I could see a change in purchasing habits from the gas vehicles if the economy gets hit, if gasoline prices rise. And I think that's the key. If gasoline prices rise to $4 and $5, you will have that transition. I mean, the only reason people started going into all these SUVs is because gasoline prices fell. So they went into the bigger vehicles, they went into the trucks, people were buying them, and of course that's what was being produced by the manufacturers. You give us $5 a gallon for gas, and you're going to have a whole different...
All bets are off.
You know, a whole different... So that tells me if they continue to push for these, you know, electric vehicles and so forth, yeah, they will push the price of oil to a much higher price. But so they'll push the consumer into those types of vehicles. But you did a newsletter. We did our newsletter. It's not out today. I'm running a little bit behind on it, ladies and gentlemen. So please be patient. But our weekly American Survive newsletter, it might go out later today. It could even be an early morning affair, but I will try to get it out today. But you wrote in the article in the today's edition about debt, which is our topic and I believe is what it's truly all about. I saw an article today about, you know, the nobody seems to really care about debt. Nobody talks about it. But you do. You do. And the holiday season is upon us, Dave.
Indeed, Melody. You know, one of the, if not the most important and certainly closely watched economic variables for gold and silver investors is debt. Government, business, and household. And we know that total government debt in the United States is wildly unsustainable. Outstanding debt issued by the federal, state, and local governments is at an astounding all-time high of $26+ trillion. That's equal to more than $79,000 per citizen. You know, on a per tax payer basis, it's even higher. And that excludes trillions of additional dollars in unfunded pension liabilities. Today, however, we focus on non-financial business and household debt with a combined $31.5 trillion as of June 30th this year, Melody. Overall, total non-financial business debt is about $15.8 trillion, while total household debt is just a little bit less, but still rounding to $15.8 trillion. In fact, I think it's a little bit higher, maybe $2 billion higher, not lower than the business debt. That's according to the Fed's latest financial stability report. Now, other sources peg total personal debt as high as $20 trillion. Not 15 plus.
You're right that the private debt has advanced roughly in line with economic activity.
Well, yeah, over the past several years, total debt owned by businesses as well as households expanded at a pace similar to that of nominal GDP, which is $21.34 trillion as of the end of the second quarter. And as a result, the non-financial sector credit to or debt to GDP ratio has been largely stable, similar to its level in mid-2005, period preceding the most rapid debt growth from 2006 to 2007, right before the Great Recession. But debt owed by businesses is still historically high, and risky debt issuance has remained alarmingly robust. Now, having growth faster than GDP through most of the current expansion, total business sector debt relative to GDP is also high by historical means. Furthermore, growth of this debt remains strong and is above the growth rate of economic output in the first half of this year. Now, debt issuance of riskier forms of business debt, you know, high-yield bonds, institutional leverage loans, which we'll talk about in a minute, shows some variation in recent quarters, but has remained robust overall in 2019. That's not a good thing, by the way. In addition, about half the investment grade debt outstanding is currently rated in the lowest category of the investment grade range, that is BBB, is near an all-time high. Again, another bad sign. In an economic turndown, Melody, widespread downgrade of bonds to speculative grade ratings could lead investors en masse to sell the downgraded bonds rapidly. And that, in turn, of course, would increase market illiquidity and downward price pressures in a segment of the corporate bond market that's known already to exhibit low liquidity.
Well, what about leverage loans?
Ah, yes, leverage loans, the crux here, I believe. Leverage loans to corporations are the fastest growing type of debt outstanding for non-financial businesses. That's basically all businesses but banks. Through the end of the second quarter of this year, balances stood at over $1.1 $3 trillion. These loans rose a whopping 14.6% since last year, owing a lot to desires for increased cash flows to buy back company stock. And they've averaged annual growth of 15+% since 1997. Now, leverage loan figures don't include the relatively small amount of leverage loans outstanding for banks and financial businesses. As I just mentioned, on balance, the Fed report says vulnerabilities arising from total private sector debt are at moderate levels. To that, I answer, really? In the same breath, the report adds that business debt levels are high compared with either business assets or GDP, with the riskiest firms accounting for the most increase in debt in recent years. And therein lies the danger, I believe. Besides those dubious characterizations by the Fed, this leveraged debt scenario begs a question. If leveraged debt continues growing at an annual rate of over 15%, just how long will it take for it to double? Well, we have an answer to that. It's a mere 4 2/3 years. That's right. In using the rule of 72, one can estimate that leveraged corporate debt could go from $1.137 trillion to $2.274 trillion in a span of less than 5 years. And it goes without saying, but several analysts say without hesitation that when the next recession hits, you know, even the less vulnerable companies with leveraged debt will find it difficult, if not impossible, to pay down what they owe. And should those corporations default on their loans, it could lead to a domino-like financial catastrophe, especially for paper investors, Melody.
Well, you know, it kind of reminds me of back in 1999 leading up to the Y2K.
Oh,
and I believe a lot of people were creating debt in mind of thinking that there would be a lot of debt that would be wiped out, you know, that the computers would crash and so forth.
They you won't know, be able to find my debt.
You know, you laugh at that, but it's... I mean, with all the information and everything out there, I mean, that was, you know, it, and my point in this is it's kind of like what's going on now with all this debt. I think everybody knows that none of this debt is going to be repaid. So as long as we all know that it's not going to be repaid, let's just go and keep adding on to the debt. Just keep creating the loans and adding more and so forth. Does that make any sense?
Well, it does. It does, and it's clear that your warning about debt not being repaid is probably most appropriate with federal government debt.
Yeah.
That I'm not sure the last year any federal government debt has been repaid. Now, to their credit, state and local governments and other, you know, related entities are required by law and actually do pay down debt because they're required to, and they do take their what's called good faith and credit of their entities a lot more seriously than Congress and the U.S. Treasury do. But I'm not sure it matters, because the other debt that's not going to be repaid, it so overshadows that which is. And even at the state and local level, the level of debt outstanding continues to rise. So what it tells me is that state and local governments are finding it increasingly difficult to live within their means, and rather than raise taxes or cut spending on a operating level, they just issue more debt. And it's coming back to bite us now. And boy, wait for the next default melody, be it in the public sector or the corporate.
And the government.
Look out.
Well, I agree. You often hear comments, we're in uncharted waters.
Yeah.
We're in a place where I don't believe to this degree any country has ever been here before. And I think it's so when it does happen and we're not living in a new era where everything is controlled. I mean, it is being controlled, but there is a day of reckoning for their recklessness and for what they're doing just to keep, you know, just to keep everything moving along.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a day of reckoning. It's not normal.
And ladies and gentlemen, these aren't just our opinions. Even I hesitate to even transition here, Melody, but even certain officials of the Federal Reserve have their eyes open about this surging corporate debt. Melody, this Dallas Fed president, Robert Kaplan, is among them. He said something recently about this.
Yeah, he's, the surging levels of corporate debt, and he laid out a scenario where it could suddenly become a big problem. Well, yeah, suddenly become a big problem. He says the thing he was worried about, if you get two or three credit downgrades, triple B down to B or to double B or B, that could lead to a rapid widening in credit spreads, which could then lead to a rapid tightening in financial conditions. He says we got a record level of corporate, to be specific, triple B debts that have tripled over the last 10 years. And all the other ratings, B and double B and B debt, have also grown dramatically. So when you're looking at the corporate debt that has swelled 90% since the Great Recession, you can look to the historic low interest rates as the reason for the high levels of debts, but I don't know, Dave.
I know. Well, we're also reading. I mean, one of the interesting aspects of household debt, getting back to your statement about debt not being repaid, is all the talk swirling around some of the Democratic presidential candidates to forgive outstanding student loans. But as it turns out, student loans and their debt isn't just a student problem. I guess we can talk a little bit more about that when we come back.
We will. Time has gone by very quickly. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned.
Oh, won't you tell me again?
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com. dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for our weekly newsletter. And, of course, these programs are archived on a daily and weekly and monthly and annual basis. So there you go. You can listen live by just clicking on the marker at the top of the page. And we are live 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Monday through Friday. And we did some replays over the holiday. It was good to have 4 days off. It was hectic. It was busy. I probably need another 4 days to recover from those 4 days.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, heading into the break, we were talking about student debt. And everyone knows that, I mean, what we still up there, and you had mentioned that you have these politicians that are looking to, allow the debt to either be reduced or be relieved from the college education. Is that correct, Dave?
Yes, I mean, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are two who started this this notion of literally forgiving all outstanding student debt. Some of the other candidates have advocated something less all-encompassing, you know, a portion of it or a reduction based on family income. But either way, even for people who see the student loan burden as a major problem for a lot of families, it's still tough to take for folks, probably millions of folks who over the years faithfully repaid their student loans, you know, every month for 10, 15 years. But we live in different times. College, the cost of education has really jumped up more than incrementally, I mean, astronomically in some cases, where the average tuition for a private college now is sometimes over $60,000 a year.
That's just...
And then think about going on to graduate school for 2, 4, 5 plus more years. Jeez.
Well, I think, too, you have to go to a college that you can afford. And I remember indeed, when we grew up, that if we couldn't afford it, we didn't go. You know, you went to work. You paid your way as you worked, and, you know, and I think there's a wonderful college, I talked about it, I believe it's in Missouri, to where you work your way through college. Gee, what a concept. How about working as you're going to school? I mean, it shows that anymore that some of these schools, I mean, not your, you know, your high-end schools and so forth, but so many of them now are just party schools. You just go to party, and you know, it's like everybody has to go to college. So many of them get degrees that they usually don't use. Not all cases, but I think we see more and more of that. It's these tuitions, but it's all part of the dollar. I'm going to bring it back to the dollar. It takes more of those dollars to buy things. Your dollar is getting weaker. It buys less. Is that the only issue with these colleges? No, but that's a big part of it. The dollars are getting less. And I'm not a fan of... And then they want to begin paying students for sports. I'm not in favor of that. I don't know if you are or not, Dave. But, you know, what does that do to tuition? Somebody's going to pay for it. So I don't... It's a big, big problem. But what are these students to do if they don't go to college? There's no jobs out there. It's not like it was where you could, you know, start in the mailroom and work yourself up anymore. I think that's a job of the past. And the gig economy, you know. But tough times are coming with technology replacing jobs. It's not everyone can be a doctor. Not everyone can be a lawyer. So, and what's next, Dave?
Well, we're reading about Social Security. There's a new report out from the Heritage Foundation that's called "Is Social Security Worth Its Cost?"
No.
We know where you stand, Melody. Now, more critics are contending that Social Security is a bad deal. Mm-hmm. They argue that the mandatory payroll tax is a poor investment because it only provides an average annual payment of $17,500. And that's a lousy return on the funds withheld over the years by or on behalf of workers. The report says Americans would be better off keeping their payroll tax contributions and putting them into private retirement accounts than having to sacrifice them to the government's broken Social Security system. That's certainly a legitimate offer, but it's also very debatable. My big concern is, unless it were still a mandatory payroll tax, If you give Americans the option of contributing even the current level of 7.65%, the employee share, and it's not mandatory, I fear that there'd be far too great a percentage of workers that wouldn't contribute. And where would that leave them in retirement? Worse off than even now. But it's debatable. It's up for debate, Melody.
But isn't it called responsibility? I mean, I think a lot of people could do more with their, you know, it's, I don't know. It's, a lot of people could do better, and you're right, people aren't, you know, they don't have it within themselves to save. And the problem also becomes, again, the weakening dollar. It buys less, so we need more of those dollars. We can't live on $800 a month anymore. But, I mean, it's... So, shouldn't we be responsible for our own retirement?
It's a question that has been on the plate now since 1980-81, the early days of the Reagan administration, during the last, what I consider the major reform of the Social Security system, occurred. And to this day, and now with this Heritage Foundation report, you know, calls for that continue. I mean, the average Social Security recipient gets about $1,461 a month this year. That'll increase to, I believe, $1,503 on January 1st. The Heritage study found that younger workers paying into Social Security over the next 3-4 decades stand to lose the most. Their returns will be between negative 0.4% and negative 14.53%. I'd like to see the math on that. The annual return is versus a 4.76 return for those making conservative private investments on their own. That's half in stocks and half in government bonds. So, once again, it's the beauty, I guess, is in the eye of the beholder, Melody. Whatever happens between now and whenever, we do know that the system faces a funding crisis within 15 years. Some would argue it's there today and has been there. But the program's reserves will become depleted in 2035. By reserves, I mean, you know, debt that's been issued on behalf of employee contributions that are in excess of benefits that are currently paid. And when they become depleted in 2035, it's going to mean a 20% cut in benefits at a minimum. So Congress will need to act sooner would be better than later.
Let's go ahead and talk a little bit about the bond yields. They're similar to Long Depression of late 1800s. What's that about, Dave? Oh, okay. We have a caller. We have Lee in Texas. Thank you for calling us, Lee. Welcome.
Howdy. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Lee.
I got one question and a comment about the debt. You know, debt is just the current form of slavery. I mean, the more money you owe, the more control they take over the people, and it's a sad thing because I don't think a lot of people realize that. They think their some $1,000 a month paycheck is going to keep coming in, they'll just keep making payments, but if that check doesn't come in, your company goes under. You know, you are in a bind immediately. It's no time to get ready. And it's just sad that people don't realize what debt really is.
You're absolutely correct.
You know, the inflation that every day takes a bite out of your savings account, whether you like it or not. You know, it just eats your money. Even if you're a good saver, frugal with your money, the government out of control and the shrinking dollar, it just eats your money. So you have to have something besides cash because it's just decreasing every day. And it's the question I have is, I know you don't give out financial advice. I'm not asking for that. But are there any general rules about how much precious metal a person should own versus what they have? Or, you know, I think you should be out of debt first before you buy to protect your assets, but that's just my opinion. But is there a rule wrote down someplace, or do we just buy all that we can afford to buy? Or,
well, you're asking the barber if you're asking the barber if you need a haircut. But, you know, the general rule is really based on what you believe is going to happen, your budgets, the funds you have available. What I try to tell folks, because I can't, you know, we give opinions and so forth. We're not financial planners. But I just kind of bring it down to a little bit of common sense. You buy gold and silver as the insurance policy. So when you insure something, you have to have a value in mind. So if you have a $100,000 home, why would you insure it for $5,000? There's a lot of folks out there saying, oh, well, you only need 5% or 10% of your assets in gold. To me, it's like, what's the point? So you really want to, to me, if you're going to have an insurance policy, if you're going to have your home insured for $100,000, well, that's how you should think with your assets. I mean, you can still be in paper, but insure it for the same amount in gold. It's just, to me, common sense. Now, if you have, and again, it's based on budgets, it's based on your you know, it's based on a lot of things, your age. So all of these should come into consideration when you're trying to decide how much gold you should have to cover your assets, because that's what we're talking about. I have a lot of clients right now, everything, the extra, their disposable incomes, it's going into gold. Because they understand that they don't know when it's going to happen, as we say on this program, day after day. But they see things changing. They see the climate changing. They see the, with everything that's going on, and just like the stock markets, you know, they're at record highs. You're not supposed to buy things when they're at record highs. You buy low, sell high, not buy high. And, but it's human nature. Everybody wants to get in. They're thinking they're missing something. So I hopefully that answers your question. And I agree with you. If you're going to save, you should be saving with gold, because you're right. All those paper dollars in those banks, you're losing against inflation every single day.
Yeah,
they know
it. It's like the cash register for the Federal Reserve. They just cash it out whether you like it or not, you know. And it's when they tell us 2% inflation, you know, I just, and that's like telling me the moon's made out of cheese. I just don't believe that number. Anyway, thanks for your time.
Thank
your
you,
skepticism
Lee.
Is well noted.
Thank you, Lee. We appreciate your call. 1-800-375-4188. We're out of time. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Mel.
And we'll be back tomorrow. So until then, be safe. Good night and God bless.
Bye-bye.
To be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.